This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Arlen Andrews was fascinated with some strange ideas early in life. Science fiction shaped his young imagination, and the thought of life on other planets made him see the stars in a whole new way. He grew up to become a successful engineer, worked at AT&T and Bell Labs, but never lost his interest in the paranormal and UFOs. He's helped with investigations of poltergeist and talked with paranormal practitioners. He even brought together a group of science fiction writers to speculate about the future of national security. Arlen Andrews is in town to speak at an event hosted by the Ryan Research Center, going to be at the Stedman Auditorium at Duke Center for Living Campus tonight, but first joins me in the studio. Welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So let's first talk about the organization that you started, SIGMA, a group of science fiction writers. Tell me about the goal.
Okay, SIGMA is a group of professional science fiction writers, over 40 of us now, who provide pro bono or free futurism consulting for the U.S. government. The goal is to get futurism thinking into the federal government. I was working in Washington 20 years ago in the White House and saw there was a real lack of imagination. Things really picked up a few years ago after 9/11, and 9/11 problems here were attributed to a lack of imagination. Department of Homeland Security asked us to come in and help solve that problem.
You had a call earlier, didn't you? You were working with the Pentagon, and they were dismissive of people who weren't actively in technology and science. They didn't like the idea of writers talking to them.
What happened was when I first put it together in 1992 at the White House, I brought together mostly PhDs that they couldn't laugh at. You know, we had to pass a giggle factor for the Beltway. So everybody involved were PhD physicists, engineers, doctors, and that sort of thing. They could not ignore us. We were technical people first. We were science fiction writers second. And the original, I put it together right before the Clinton administration was coming in. They were not really interested because they had their own bright people and their own bright ideas. But we did a little bit of things over the years of various people. But about 5 years ago, Homeland Security brought us in.
Tell us about that. What was that meeting all about?
Okay, they brought us in. We acted like a panel does at a science fiction convention. About a bunch of people sitting around. They asked us questions. What worries you most? What do you think about particular instances that I can't talk about? They would ask us for a science fiction solution to a certain incident. Sometimes our solutions were very low-tech, having to do with cell phones being able to communicate when the towers go down like they did in Katrina. Why can't cell phones communicate with each other? What sort of legislation do you have in effect in case there's a national catastrophe and communities can't talk to each other? How do you want the locals to react? How do you help firemen rescue people from burning buildings? I mean, it went from very low to very policy-oriented. And these were not your father's bureaucrats. These people said, don't censor yourselves at all. You can outrage us if you wish. Well, I won't go into details, but in several cases, within 30 seconds, we took them from shock, surprise, to outrage. But they listened, and they invited us back year after year.
Outrage as in that's impossible? Talk about
outrage as in we were as politically incorrect as you could possibly be, and I'm not going to mention that on NPR.
Yeah.
I have before on other NPR broadcasts than in Texas. But things that you're not supposed to say that or you're not supposed to think that, but they told us up front, no censorship.
Well, what's that got to do with science fiction, the politically? I don't actually get the connection here because you're talking about technological kinds of solutions.
Not,
right?
No, actually, we're talking about many sociological or psychological or financial as well as technological. In a science fiction convention, you have panels of writers come from different backgrounds. They talk about future everything, future technology, future politics, future space travel, future sex, future sociology, the future of the Middle East. Typically, mostly in the future. And the idea is science fiction writers will do anything for a story. So you throw out everything and start from scratch. And you're willing to consider new paradigms. You look at new possibilities and new realities. Anything for a story. The same sort of thinking can work very well for government planners who are thinking about the future. We presented them with things they'd never thought about. Several instances to do with how they were going to apply cell phones for radiation and biological monitors. They were going to do it. Good idea. They hadn't thought it through. We helped them with that. I was on Squawk Box a few years ago talking about that. We just think in different ways. I call it science fictional thinking. We're just trying to affect the way they think, not give them We don't know what the future is, but we can give them possibilities.
You were also invited to Saudi Arabia by the government there. What did they want?
The Global Competitiveness Forum was held there in January. They asked us to come and present a panel on disruptive technologies. Now, we had to be a little bit careful about what we're talking about, because with my interest in the paranormal, I wasn't going to present that in Saudi. The month before we got there, they had just beheaded somebody for sorcery. And in fact, last month, they beheaded a guy for fortune-telling. But on the one hand, the young generation is reaching out, trying to become 21st century themselves. They have some other people there who are kind of holding them back, so it's a tug-of-war. But they were gracious enough to invite us, to treat us like rock stars almost. They listened to what we talked about, and the things I mentioned to them primarily were science fictional thinking. My underlying agenda was, if you're going to think like a science fiction writer, you really have to have a democratic society. You can't be held down by a fundamentalist belief of any sort, here or there. You have to think differently. I was very happy that just this week, 2 days before I left to come down here, I got a Facebook message to go to a YouTube link by one of the Arabs that we had met in Saudi. He was giving a talk 2 months after we left over in Qatar, saying that Arabs need science fiction to help them dream better and to do better inventions. So it took. Our influence there actually helped a small bit.
Though it's interesting because we have a democracy here, and yet we're very much held down by fundamentalist thinking very often in terms of, I mean, we have a legislature that doesn't want to measure the sea level rise. In the future, it wants to measure past sea level rise. That's sort of fundamentalist thing, and yet it's a democratic. So it's not really democracy so much as fundamentalism and whether or not religious views make their way into the marketplace and stifle creative and scientific thinking, which happens all the time in the United States.
At least here, we've never beheaded anybody for fortune-telling.
But you can certainly end up without a job. So this is all very interesting. How did you get interested in all this stuff?
As a child, my great-grandmother and grandmother filled me full of Cherokee stories, and I don't know if we really are Cherokee or not, but I heard about it. Ghost stories, strange things in the sky, strange things in the woods. When I was in second grade, as I mentioned before, I think to the interviewer yesterday, the Weekly Reader, a newspaper that I think still exists, took us on a tour of the solar system. This is in the late 1940s now. And we went to the different planets, and we visited Pluto back when it was still a planet, in the little newspaper. And while we're there, imaginary voyage, a saucer-shaped craft comes up to us and then disappears and takes off. And I asked the teacher, where did it go? Where did it come from? She said, oh, there are probably creatures living around other planets, around other stars. And whoa, for a 7, 8-year-old kid, my mind expanded, and I went and looked at the stars at night, and I've never looked at them any differently. Now, since then, I've had an education. I got a doctorate in engineering and a lot of experience and done a lot of things. So the education came later, but the interest was first. Science fiction at an early age, 9 or 10 years old, also helped stretch it. I had some other strange experiences I won't get into. I'll mention those tonight and tomorrow. But to me, reality has always been broad. The technical education later helped me to focus it and gave me what I consider a BS filter. That stands for basic science. Maybe everything is possible, but not everything is probable.
Yeah.
You can't believe in everything.
Well, one of those strange experiences was a UFO. You saw something that you've yet to explain.
My mother and I were standing with the preacher. This is out in rural Arkansas, outside Little Rock in the woods, about 1951. And we were talking. My mother and I both saw something the size of the moon, the apparent diameter of the moon, do an oscillatory motion across the sky lasting 3 or 4 seconds. It scared everything out of me at the time, just about. I had no idea that anything like that could exist. Could have been a meteor, but it was disc-shaped and... So, but it fit right into my perception of reality that there are strange things that occur. I decided at an early age to look at the strange things. All the neat things are being covered by people smarter than me and Nobel Prize people. I wanted to look in the small corners and what's happening in a dark room over in the corner. Maybe there's something.
So when you put that through your BS filter, how do you make sense of that? You and your mother both saw it. There's no other explanation for it. And yet you don't have to go right to extraterrestrial life. There's a lot of possibilities. So what do you do with that?
Record it. Mm-hmm. I think I call myself a 4T and a person who likes to study the works of Charles Fort, who wrote several books about unusual phenomena. Your only obligation is to record it and publish it somewhere so that maybe 100 years from now somebody else can put it together with something else that happened maybe in Siberia they can put it together and say, oh, that's what it really was.
Yeah.
Right now, we don't know.
And you worked at AT&T Bell Labs.
Yes.
So how, and that's, you know, there you are. You've got your PhD. You're working in technology in a legitimate lab. How does your thinking affect your work?
It actually helped. I, you know, got a reputation for being creative, and that helped with the career. Actually, for a while in Indianapolis, we had a weekly parapsychology meeting that I hosted, and I brought in speakers, and we had presentations on various weird subjects. I was trying to get all these really bright people who were really good with instruments and things interested in this sort of thing, so they'd go out and do research on their own. That went on for a couple of years.
So what are ways in which science fiction in the past has really come true? Because so much of it has, or a good some of it, certainly, what science fiction writers wrote as crazy stuff turned out to be exactly what we're doing these days.
If you will look at the YouTube I mentioned this week, this guy named Yasser Bajat talking in gutter about Arab science fiction can bring about better dreams. He started to talking about the per capita number of science fiction publications is proportional to the number of patents all over the world. And he was saying his part of the world has very few patents and no science fiction. He mentioned specifically Jules Verne and his predictions, and H.G. Wells and his description of the atomic bomb, called it by that name back in about 1915. Those are very notable predictions. But science fiction only looks into possibilities. Like I said, anything for a story.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody says, yeah, we science fiction writers predict the future like a duck hunter shoots down ducks. You send out 1,000 pellets, and if you're lucky, one hits and brings it down. So we're not in the prediction business. If we were, we'd be billionaires, you know.
But as you say, it's a way of thinking, rather than looking backward, how did we get from here to there? It's looking forward and imagining. In fact, at one point you talked about, and I think you were only speaking about trying to come up with in the future a kind of slang language in the future, but you talked about taking your mind out of gear in order to do that. I mean, describe that process. What does that mean, to take your mind out of gear and allow yourself to think in a new way?
Well, nobody's ever asked that particular question.
I just threw your mind out of gear.
It's out of gear. Well, this is not meant to be ethnic or anything, but I have friends who have very thick foreign accents, typically from Southeast Asia. And in order to understand the English, the perfectly good English they're saying with different accents, I have to back off and, okay, let me pick up the meaning and not the exact syllables. That's the sort of thing that I do when I'm thinking of a story. Throw out what we know about science and history. A story might start off with an idea. You see a piece of equipment that looks kind of strange, or a couple of words come together. I had a couple of words come together one time. Parameters of dream flight. Those things hit me. I said, that's kind of funny. So I stored that back in the back room back here. And about 5 years later, a story popped out. The guys in the back room open the door and they throw out a manuscript and I try to read it, and that's how it works. It's a subconscious thing. You, as I said in Saudi Arabia, and I'll mention again tonight, I canvassed the 40 members of Sigma. I said, what is it we do different? How are we thinking different? I know we think different. What is it? They said, well, basically we recognize, we associate, and we correlate disparate data. We look for different trends, patterns, and anomalies, and jumble it all together and to a verb and a noun stick together, and pretty soon it's just like a Petri dish. It grows and grows and grows, and hopefully there's something useful and publishable at it.
Well, you used the word several times, story, meaning a kind of narrative-driven imagination versus using another language. Math is a fine language. It's a highly abstract and wonderful language, but it's not the same as the sort of narrative language that
right.
we use to create images or to describe the image that sort of pops in your head as a vision and say, well, how do I describe that picture that just came to mind?
That's the entire thing. I recently put out an ebook novel called Valley of the Shaman, plug here. It was almost like an automatic writing thing. I was visiting a valley, the Jemez Valley in New Mexico, looking at some ruins, and all of a sudden these images start to come in. So I sat down. This was like 10 years ago. I sat down, and I wish I could record the video right from my brain, but I can't, not yet. 10 years from now, you probably can do that. But so I started trying to describe what it is that I see. And sometimes it's hard to find the words. Other times the scenes just flow, and as a lot of short stories I've done, and all my publications have been short stories and articles and things, it's almost like cheating. I didn't really do that, but I'll take a check.
You know? That's right. Got these pictures. All I have to do is caption the things. So you, I know, are very interested in seeing much more scientific research on things that we now call paranormal. Tell us where you'd like to see more research.
Well, as I mentioned to some people this morning during another tour, the Higgs boson was revealed last week. It was finally found after 20 years and billions of dollars and 6,000 scientists, and I'm very happy for it. I know it's not the ultimate. 10, 20 years from now, there will be 15 flavors and varieties of boson. I'd like to see just 1/100% of those resources put towards something like studying survival after death, studying the various things called ESP or psi today. Any given one of those put in proof and practice would revolutionize what we think about ourselves and the race and everything else. It might give us a chance with some people to look back into the past like an instrument, or maybe, as I've experienced a few times, into the future. The future is, in some fashion, some possibilities, is really out there. Healing of various diseases we have now. A better understanding of how human beings are plugged into the universe and vice versa. It'd be nice to know, do we survive after death?
A lot of this stuff is very measurable. If you talk about precognition or healing, I mean, we know that there are energy fields. They're measurable. We don't know quite how they work, and we don't know quite what they do. It seems to me you could design some pretty simple experiments to begin testing.
Right. I'll be mentioning some of those tonight. There are 40 years ago, I wrote my first paid publication in Fate magazine called Toward a Unified Parascience. It was a speculative account of how a human soul, independent of the body, could develop naturally, nothing to do with any supernatural at all, just a natural process, and how it might survive afterwards. And I was in favor at that time of taking every kind of instrumentation that there was and humanely observing a person who's dying. I mean, I've already volunteered to do that. My wife will let them, you know, if I go first, and we're aware of it. Look at everything we're using to measure the galaxies and the Earth and the planets and the sun and everything else, put those instruments in a nice hospice room, roll the person in, and see if anything happens at the moment of death. Now, also, you could do the same sort of thing. A person is a gifted psychic or healer. Bill Joynes and other people are doing research at the Rhine. They can pick up photons coming from people who are healers and meditators and Tai Chi masters. They can pick that up. So let's look at that while they're living, and let's look at it when somebody's dying. There's so much can be done. I'm an engineer. I believe in instrumentation and measurements.
Yeah, it'd be fascinating stuff. And along the way, it seems to me that what you picked up along the way, even if you couldn't demonstrate the hypothesis, if you couldn't prove it, you could learn a lot along the way. Thanks very much. Good to talk with you, Arlen.
Thank you for having me.
Arlen Andrews, professional engineer and a writer, speaks at an event sponsored by the Rhine Research Center at the Stedman Auditorium at Duke Center for Living tonight, 7:30. Also going to lead a workshop there tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. For more information about the events, go to rhinecenter.org. Rhine is R-H-I-N-E. We are going to be live from Greensboro, by the way, this Tuesday, Triad Stage. We do that every month. This one is coming up this Tuesday, and you can be in the audience. Send us an email at rsvp@wunc.org, and you can be in the audience. Coming up, live music in our studio, Yolanda Rabin. Stay with us.